My clock's off.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Paranexus Universe, everyone. Today is Thursday, April 16th, 2009. This is your host, Doug Kelly, here with Grant Rubendunz. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. Welcome, everybody. It's nice to have you with us tonight.
Yes, it is. We've got another great guest with us tonight. Bob Otis is going to join us here in just a moment. We're going to talk about time travel. And if you've got questions about the discussion tonight, we'd love to take them in the chat room. You can go to Blog Talk Radio. That's probably where you're at. Just click on the chat. If you're not in the chat room, come on in and join us and ask your questions. If you want to call in tonight, you can do that. I'm going to post the number in the chat room, and it should be there on your screen as well. And if you've got a headset and a mic and you want to use that click to talk button, you can call us using that as well. So tonight we talk about time travel. And we've got Bob Otis, and he is the author of A Testimony of Lions, which is a novel about time travel. Let me give you a little bit of background on Bob. He was born in a small house in 1929 in the equally small town of Payne, Ohio. 6 months later, his parents moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he grew up almost. He graduated from school in Westwood, California. In 1950, he was drafted into the U.S. Army, where he served part of the time with military history as a combat artist in Korea. After his discharge from the service, he spent most of his career years in the forest products industry. He moved on to his boat in Long Beach for 4 years to do some writing before moving to Oregon in 1991. He now divides his time between Oregon coast and southern Baja, Mexico, where he is currently. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you very much. Linda, by the way, my fiance, she added those almost.
Yeah.
Grown up.
Yeah, I didn't read that part. It's the author is almost grown up.
Welcome to the show, Bob. It's nice to have you with
Thank
us.
Thank you, guys. Hey, I love that intro music.
Oh, yeah.
What a mood that put you in, yeah.
Yeah, that was the Doug in a bad moment. All right, I had help from the mixer.
Yeah, we had to take that away from him eventually, Bob.
Yeah, funny. So
every time you have a good time here.
Oh, we do. It's
trying to.
More of an informal, laid-back show, and we talk about things that are mysterious and unknown and paranormal and all of that on a variety of topics, and so. We're happy to have you on this time travel. Of course, everybody is usually interested in time travel, and it's theoretically possible according to what we know about physics. So tell us, let's start off. Tell us about your book, A Testimony of Lions. What prompted you to write it? And, let's get into our discussion.
Well, like you said, it's probably the most interesting subject matter I can think of, and I could not have a story without having delved into time travel. And I had a call from a guy the other night, calling from London, an interview talk show, and he was trying to get me to insist that I knew something I didn't know that I knew about time travel. And I said, look, I'm a science fiction writer. I read things other people say, but I said, I'm not a physicist. And he spent 24 minutes trying to get me to say something. But, I have no idea. I think it can be. There's a gentleman named Stephen Hawking who thinks it is possible. And you don't get much brighter than him. Too bad.
Yep.
Poor body in the shape it's in. But,
you're going to disappoint our audience tonight, Bob, by not being part of Black Ops and not having all the secrets.
No.
Gosh darn it.
No. He's a plant. He is part of Black Ops.
In the book, there's a way how he does it, and how you know, my little pea brain come up with it, and I didn't put him in a DeLorean and run him down the street with fire behind him and stuff like that.
Oh, how good be that!
Absolute way. What he does is he's been about 17 years working for NASA, or I should say for RAND Corporation, one of these top secret think tanks, and. About 17 years, he's been down the wrong path of just special and general relativity. And he finally does cross over into quantum mechanics and physics. And by the time he got down in the middle there, he came up with an equation that did allow him to double the speed of light. And that set up his own time reversal continuum. And he actually formed his own wormhole through space and time. And he went back to the first century in Jerusalem, in Judea. Because he felt that the only reason you and I are talking out here right now, it can only be one of two reasons, unless somebody's come up with a third alternative, and that's either creation and or evolution. And I don't know if anybody's come up with another, and they both are unprovable, and they both take faith to believe in. A faith is usually what's defined as something you haven't seen or you haven't witnessed yourself, but still you believe in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's required just as much in evolution as it is in religion. It's usually associated with religion, like, you know, well, where did God come from? Well, I don't know. You got to have faith, you know.
Right.
Questions like that. But no Christian has ever been around today has ever seen Jesus Christ. No Jew has ever seen Moses. No scientist has ever seen the Big Bang. So we're kind of going on stuff we've learned and read from other people.
Yeah.
And to me, the interesting part of the whole thing is the journey itself. I mean, you can't go back in a pair of Levi's and a T-shirt and some Nikes, you know. If you're going to go back in that period, you better be dressed like they are. You better speak the language. You better have your own, make your own clothing, your own sandals, your own money, your own everything. And even if you learn the language, the pronunciation over 2,000 years has changed so much. You're probably going to sound silly. And this poor guy's major disadvantage is he was well over 6 foot tall. The average guy back there is 5'5", so he stood out like secretary at a barn full of mules, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had all kinds of disadvantages. But there's a love story. The publisher really had what do I do with this thing? Is it a love story? Is it adventure story? Science fiction? Religious? But there's no preaching or teaching or anything like that going on there. That, I'll promise you. The main thing is the journey itself and the things he runs into and the things that you just enjoy putting yourself in his sandals and walking along.
So, Bob, let me just ask you a question because I'm a little bit unclear. This guy goes back in time to the first century A.D., correct?
Correct.
Okay. What's the significance of the first century B.C. as far as how he's going to determine whether it's creation or evolution?
Okay. This takes a little twist because he did get into some theocratic studies and in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It says that Jesus Christ was the firstborn of all God's creation, and all things were created through him.
Oh, okay.
That's creation. There we go. That's the guy I want to talk to.
Okay.
So that's what the story is. He goes back to see him.
Mm.
And he gets in all kinds of trouble because...
Well, that's a fascinating period of time because of all the activities that were going there. So does he go to Jerusalem? Is that what I heard you say?
Yes, well, yeah. Everything's a turmoil. Political.
Sure, everything
turmoil,
was.
Roman occupied.
Romans, yep,
yep.
Judaism was kind of recreating itself at that time, if I recall.
Exactly. It was all...
a hotbed of social malcontents as well.
Right.
Revolutionaries,
otherwise known as Christians.
Well, no, there were Jews. The Jews were fighting against Roman occupation, and they had stomped out.
Correct.
And within the next probably 30, 40 years, they completely just razed the temple right to the ground there. They burned it to the ground.
The zealots, what we would refer to as terrorists today, or the Romans would refer to as terrorists.
Wow.
They wanted them out. It was just a time of terrible turmoil, and they just weren't. Well, there's a little guy, speaking of the Jews, but his name was Saul, and he had a very nasty disposition, and he really persecuted Christians a lot. And now, a little bit later on the road to Damascus, now millions of people today know him as St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time this guy ran into him, he just was a mean little guy. he didn't like him. And he's got some of these almost like 007 or whatever. He brings a lot of modern stuff with him back there that he can do things with. But people say, well, who are you, or what are you doing? And the United States government's going nuts because they got this thing out there that they don't know where it is. The guy took it unauthorized.
Mm-hmm.
And what if any other nation? I wrote it, by the way, during the plugged it in before while it was still the Soviet Union instead of before the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody in the world could, if they ever found out, we could fix wheat prices or pork bellies or what the gold spot's going to be or where oil, and if they knew that we had equipment like that, the whole world economy would collapse. So this was the best kept secret since the Manhattan Project, or even better.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of a mystery of the book, The United States government's going nuts looking for the guy, and they're looking for him back there, and he's still looking for who he's looking for, and it's just I think he really is a lot plugged into a very small book.
Mm-hmm.
In this thing, but time travel, to me, I don't think any night I go to bed that I say, well, who do I visit tonight, Leonardo da Vinci, or do I want to see Voltaire, or how about Copernicus? Can you just imagine chatting with these people and seeing exactly how they thought? Like, religion, as you know, ran. They were science, and the Earth was the center of the universe. Well, da Vinci knew better than that, and
Copernicus.
Yeah, Copernicus certainly did. He did not release his work until the day he died because he didn't want the problems of heresy and all that sort of stuff. They weren't very nice in those days if you disagreed with them. And they knew that the Earth was the center of the universe. But now even Leonardo da Vinci spent the last 12 years, he's like, he recanted. He said, no, I made a mistake. The Earth is the center. But he spent the last 12 years under what today we would call house arrest for even holding the view. But then I guess it was 1859 or something like that, this guy Darwin come along and writes this stuff about how we evolved from lower animals. And that became what is taught in all institutions of higher learning today.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's this little 3 foot tall female hairy thing, Africanus, Lepithecus, and that went into Homo sapiens, Homo erecti, Neanderthal, into Cro-Magnon, and so here we are talking today on an intelligent level that if we can survive our own technology, I'd be dying to see where we're going to be 1,000 years from now, if we can get into time travel.
Well, time travel. What do you think, Bob? About do you have any elements of the old time travel paradox within your story? Given any of the plot away, is there a paradox, or do you personally think there's a paradox with time travel?
Well, as I said, this book asks all the questions that are unanswerable, and I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to conceive of something re-happening that's already happened, and you get in all the things. Well, what if you did one little thing to change it?
Mm-hmm.
What if you stepped on a bug, or what if you ran
Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury, one of the finest science fiction short stories ever written. where
right.
what you said just exactly happened. And that's a fantastic,
yeah.
that's what a terrific short story that is.
Now,
but yeah, the ramifications of one simple misstep over the course of millennia.
Well, I bring up the thing in the book about, let's suppose we went back to, say, 1932, and we got some loudmouth little paper hanger over there in Berlin, and what if we took him and a guy named Goring and a guy named Goebbels and, some of his cohorts, Hess, and took them out, what would happen? Would there have been a World War II?
Exactly. It depends on what you adhere to. If you believe in quantum physics, then, it does happen. They kill him, and it splits off into an infinite number of different timelines.
Exactly.
So that's the most fascinating part about it.
I know Ray Bradbury, such a great writer, but when he says, beam me up, Scotty, and, Scotty, he breaks down every atom in your body, he transports it to a different place and reassembles it, I think if that's possible, time travel is certainly possible.
Yeah.
Because that's really a stretch to do. But that was
Gene Roddenberry. That wasn't Ray Bradbury. Gene Roddenberry was Star Trek.
You're right.
Bradbury is probably one of the greatest American short story science fiction writers ever.
Right.
No doubt about it. But when you think about that, because that violates all the laws of quantum physics. Hence, in Star Trek, they had to have the Heisenberg converter to compensate for the fact that nobody can ever, according to quantum theory, if I'm halfway correct, can be able to predict the position of one atom at any space in any place and time.
That's my understanding also. They have these what they call colliders going right now. They've got one 4 miles long here in the United States, and they're building one 17 miles long over in Switzerland. And what they're trying to do is get one atom to collide with another, and that's supposed to form a little black hole, and that'll tell us a lot of stuff. But they're just propelled by high-powered magnets, and they just pick up. They don't reach light speed, but according to Einstein, if you ever reach light speed, at least you would get the ultimate, if matter ever did, I should say, it would turn into the ultimate mass and time itself would stop. But that can't be if we...
You can't do it in Einstein's universe.
That's right.
And so therefore, with the whole theory is that the faster you go, the more mass you accumulate. So that you can never cross that threshold point. But I've always kind of wondered, and I'm sure you have too, Bob, is how do we know that, we all know that a black hole is a star that's collapsed in upon itself, and gravity has become so great and so dense and so kind of intensified in one spot that not even light can escape. So when that occurs, the black hole disappears from the universe, so how can we say that with a magnetic field strong enough, you can't rip the fabric of time and space and create your own little black hole or wormhole?
Well, that's of course. You just hit it right in the button right there. What's on the other side of that? Is there a parallel universe? Going down on that thing, supposed to rip everything apart. It's supposed to be unimaginable density, and supposedly. There's one in every galaxy. There's 350 billion galaxies and 350 billion stars in every galaxy, and probably several in our own little galaxy. We're sitting here and
several black holes.
85% of everything in the universe is made up of dark matter.
Right.
That's something you can't touch, feel, smell, but they know it's there. The same as dark energy.
Yep.
And there's two separate things. But gravity is what brings these constellations
and we really don't even understand gravity fully yet.
Nobody understands it,
and we're like light years away from it. But the potential for using gravity for not only space travel but for traveling in time is seems to be there.
I know that little what was it, Voyager that they sent out. 1974 or something like that, and had no particular plan, no particular objective except to travel on as far as it could through space, And it passed Pluto, or what used to be Pluto. It's still a planet anymore. But anyway,
it's outer rings of our.
Yeah, right. It's about 11 or 12 billion miles past that right now. And by the time it would reach Alpha Centauri, which is a cluster, the nearest star, that's about 40 light years away, 4.2, something like that. It's going to be 50,000 years at the speed that thing traveled. Now, who's going to be around to say hello or answer the phone? You know,
hope somebody is.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that we're a long, long way from, you know, traveling out of Star Trek, you know, to Tau Ceti and then come back for dinner in the afternoon.
Well,
you know, that's a long ways away, but, you know, when one thinks of the potential to fold space or to bend space, then, you know, distance is not even relevant.
Did you ever see I'm sure you have, what you're interested in, this thing with Jodie Foster called Contact?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The fact that she went, you know, she went through the wormholes, et cetera, and of course nobody believed her, and this and that. But to me, there was a line in there, something about they said, what question would you ask somebody if you met them out there and, you know, they're a million years in advance of our technology, et cetera. She said, the thing she would ask is, how did they survive their own technology? In other words, here we are. And ever since man picked up a bone and hit another one over the head to get to a water hole, this is 2001 Space Odyssey started out, we've been fighting in war, and now we have the technology to turn this whole thing into a cinder, but we've gone 50 or 60 years, which is a blink of an eye in history, and we're still, we still got a lot of threats, but if we can survive that, that would be the accomplishment of to where we would say, well, look, this business of killing each other isn't working. We got to find some other way here, and then let's just take a turn and dedicate it all towards science.
And
if we could survive that and evolve into that, that would be something to be worthwhile to be around to see.
Yes, it would. And it's not so much a matter of, will we survive our technology? It's a matter of what will we survive ourselves. Technology,
our humanity, right.
Gives us the ability to kill us all off. And I'm with you. You know, I mean, Stanton Friedman talks about it. You know, a planet that's primary activity is tribal warfare. And if we can only get past that need to hurt and harm and kill and the control, the greed, the, you know, and I think it'll come. I think it'll come in the future. I think we will evolve. Now,
well,
Bob, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, are you familiar with the Philadelphia experiment?
No.
Okay. Then we won't go into that. That's was supposedly a time travel experiment. So your book, if I understand correctly, really explores this issue of creationism versus evolution.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, and you explore the issue without I'm not going to say much because I don't want to, you know, give it away or anything, but it basically you just explore that issue.
Well, yes, except one thing. The main purpose the only thing that I tried to accomplish with the book was to keep it interesting and make it as believable as possible. But I could have made this thing 5,000 pages long if I explored every avenue that you and I might sit down and say, well, let's take this tack, let's take that tack. And I thought it would just bore a lot of people, with somebody trying to, because I'm not a genius or a scientist or anything. All I can do is report. I know that the moon's 234,000 miles from the Earth, and I know the sun's 92 million miles, and I know that the universe is supposed to be 14.2 billion years old. But I can't prove any of these things. This is just stuff I've read. And so I can, you know, tell stories about it and make up things. But
well, then let's do what your book does for the sake of controversy and the fact that we're doing a live radio show.
Yes.
Let's explore the whole creation versus evolution thing. And I'm going to start it off by saying, by asserting, for the sake of argument, that believing in creationism takes a hell of a lot more faith than believing in evolution.
I would say so from the standpoint of the ologies that we have developed in the last 100 years. You know, paleontology, zoology, geology, all the things that give you proof of you know, a jawbone, everything from a tooth to a total skeleton to the ice core drillings that go back 2.5 million years, and they can tell what the temperatures were and how much, if a volcano erupted that year or what, you know, there's just so much more scientific evidence that leans towards evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And creation, all you have is some books. And that's enough for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
They just say, you know, okay, this is what I think. And you know, when you put, you write down your money, there's things against, like, in God we trust. Well, you know, God means so much to different people.
Right.
And, you know, people can run all kinds of different avenues with that. When you just say, okay, creation without instrumentation sounds impossible. In other words, I'm just willing something to be. There's a planet, and I'm going to make it perfect, and I'm going to put two perfect little people on it. And everything is perfect except for one thing. It wasn't really one thing. Well, yeah, free will.
Mm-hmm.
You give people free will, and supposedly all the angels, et cetera, that he ever created had free will. And a lot of bad choices were made, so things got all messed up, and this was the whole reason why Jesus Christ had to pay the ransom price for the bad choices made by what the Bible refers to as Adam and Eve. And yes, it does. I agree with you. It sounds
it's kind of contradictory, because had he stayed alive, had he remained alive and not had such a messy and bloody death, he might have been able to achieve a lot more by living instead of dying at the age of, what, 32?
Three. And that's, of course, assuming that he actually existed.
Right.
Well, that's the only thing they do know, that he did exist. I mean, we don't know that Moses exists. We don't know that Abraham
was. Who was it? Who was it historically, Bob?
Josephus.
I'm a little bit reluctant to endorse Josephus, and here's the reason why. Josephus didn't report on that until long. He was a captive of Vespasian, I believe, and he was a traitor to the Jewish nation. He was a traitor, and he was a prisoner of the Romans, and he lived about 60 years after Jesus, well, at least 30 to 40 years after Jesus died.
Let's say 100, I think.
Josephus had a real inclination to embellish his stories. He was great at reporting what Jerusalem or Rome was like at the time that he lived, but historically, I'm troubled by some of the statements that he makes.
Well, he had the philosophy, and I kind of agree with it, that nobody should write about the era that they live in lest their own personal prejudices are brought into the thing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I'm sure the Japanese would write a different type of history than the Germans 100 years from now than they would have right after Hiroshima or Nagasaki or something.
Yeah, I would buy that, especially in light of the fact that his people were a conquered people, and that, you know, what he was doing at that time was trying to boost the morale of those people. But the part that also troubles me a lot about Josephus is his character, because if you recall from history, Josephus was at one point part of the Jewish uprising. He came from a wealthy aristocratic family, and he was part of an insurrection. They were in a fortress someplace, and when it looked like they were all surrounded and the Romans were going to get him, They all went down into the cellar, and they said, we're all going to commit suicide, and we're going to draw lots. And everybody killed themselves except Josephus. When it got down to his turn, he decided, nah, I think I'd rather go with the Romans. And that's
that
a true story.
That sounds a lot like Masada.
That's a true story. No, Josephus surrendered to the Romans.
All right.
But not, okay, now you say that's a true story. I would have no idea of knowing whether it is or whether it is not. But,
well, read the history of Josephus. And, I mean, I'm not trying to contradict anything. I just know that Josephus was a traitor to his own people.
Okay. Well,
was he a zealot?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Let's do this. Let me just add that there is some belief that the reference to Jesus by Josephus was spurious, was added later. But let's take this in a different direction. We do have a caller on the line on the topic of time travel and expanding possibilities, and let's take that call. Welcome, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what's your first name?
Hello, am I on?
Yeah, you're on, but we can't hear you very well.
Can you speak up a little bit for us, caller?
32 man, 7 dude. Yes,
what's your first name?
32 man, 7 dude. I just
what's your first name?
He doesn't have one.
Man, 7 dude.
He can't remember.
Hey, T-Rex, we can't hear you very well. You had some comments on... Yeah, that's a little better. You had some comments on time travel? Yeah.
Yep.
That's better.
All right, so I was, flipping through my science channel, from the Discovery Channel. Science channel on TV and picked up the show about quantum physics and some time travels. The time travels and the quantum physics were like impossible now.
Right. And like, what did they say was the reason they're possible?
Well, they were talking about the superposition is. I don't know if you're familiar with the superposition is, but they're talking about the superposition is and like. Superpositioning?
Supersymmetry,
you
mean?
The Brumac factor. The Brumac factor, too. Are you familiar with the Brumac factor?
Mm-mm. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, the Brumac is an acronym for Brumac. So the B stands for B, the R stands for R, the U stands for B, the M stands for M, the A stands for A, and the K stands for K. And it's a Brumac.
Cool. So, we appreciate that. Anything else you want to throw in there?
Yeah, I'm just going to let you guys know. This is a T-Rex 1 cool 32 man 7 dude calling in straight out of West Philadelphia, born and raised. Playgrounds where I spent most of my days chilling out, maximum, all cool, some b-ball outside of school. When it comes
yeah, you're
out.
A regular M&M, T-Rex.
All right, thanks so much, dude, and I appreciate your call. Let's go with a little bit of that on the time travel thing, the multiverse. I don't know if that's explored much in your book, Bob, or not.
I could barely hear him.
We couldn't either.
About every other word there, so
that's fine.
I'm not even qualified to respond.
He was a wee bit confused in his mind too. I think.
So,
I think he was getting supersymmetry jumbled up with some other concept.
So, Bob, in your book, do you explore the topic of multiverses in some fashion or different, do you go into that much?
No. The only thing I've had him do was most of it had to do with the preparation for one journey to one spot to one place. In other words, it's not like... he's going to be jumping all over the universe or all over the time era, time span era. So he's more or less dedicated to what it takes to survive at that particular place. Now there is one thing that I did do, and it's a science fiction writer's liberty. The guy has a molecular structure breakdown, not breakdown, I should say buildup, after he becomes aware of the fact that he has left Pasadena, California, and he didn't end up in the middle of the ocean someplace because he had to do, he had to program his computers to how many revolutions that the Earth has made in the 2,000 years. And so hopefully he would end up on the that side of the planet and not have to spend the rest of his life with North American Indians, or end up in the Atlantic Ocean someplace. But this phenomenon that took place within him gave him, you might say, super strength. He didn't miniaturize himself or anything. He was the same size he was, but he would pick up a boulder and it would just kind of melt in his hand or crush in his hand and get warm. The guy had, and nobody could pick up his backpack because it weighed probably much as a mule, and so he runs into, you just have to see the different characters he runs into in this thing. And one night he made a mistake. He didn't know where he was, and he heard something, and he flashed a light out over the desert, and some little guy saw this thing and come up to his little cave he was sleeping in, about 2 feet tall. And he hit his head, and he woke up, and he didn't know what language this guy was speaking. He didn't know where he was, and so he had to wait for this guy to talk first, and finally he found out he was talking in Aramaic, and he was a little scribe in a year, and he was learning all about what they did to the process in writing the scrolls. And again, his job was to count every letter so there couldn't be any mistakes. And if they got, supposedly this is where the Dead Sea Scrolls came from, that they, if they did find a mistake, it had reached a state too close to holiness, they couldn't destroy it. They burnt the ends of it, stuck it in a jar, and hid them someplace. And they didn't find them until by the Dead Sea there until, 1947 or something like that. So that was just part of the historical things that he had to learn. And of course, he was anxious to learn everything he could learn. But
and I'm really talking about you, because obviously you're exploring things throughout the thing. Because this is, some interesting philosophical stuff. What kind of, I don't know, did you have any aha moments as you were writing this concerning some of these issues, either with time travel or with, evolution versus creationism?
Well, sure, I am that guy. I still don't know the answer.
Any aha moments, any things that you thought, I didn't know that before?
Yeah, well, I had to do obviously some research on the architecture and the layout of the city and et cetera of all of first century Judea, because they come up through Hebron, up through Beersheba, into Bethlehem, and then into Judea. He just didn't plant himself right in the middle of the temple someplace. There's a whole journey involved in this thing. And there's no preaching or there's no teaching, and I'm not trying to convert anybody. I don't attend a service myself. I think I'm closer to where you guys are as far as there's just too much we don't know, and yes, religion does seem like in many cases it's been more of a problem on this planet than it has been good.
Well, the whole thing is it's such a fascinating time period, though, that you got your story wrapped up in, Bob. That time is just so, it's so juicy as far as all the different plot lines. So I'm sure, the folks in our audience would just be delighted to read it because it's going to have so many different things going on and so many experiences for your main person to, go through and kind of explore.
The timetable was one that was just days, almost hours prior to the infamous kiss from Judas.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy knows it because he read about it. But back then, they did at least 11. Beautiful, loyal, kind of not too bright guys going along with something. They had no idea what road they were traveling. They didn't understand what he was there for or anything else. This guy did because he read scriptures 2,000 years later. But those people didn't know back then. And I'm sure when Jesus died, they probably thought, oh, boy, we backed the wrong horse. Or, you know, was this supposed to happen? You know, they didn't really know what was going on. Of course, you know, 3 days later, there was a resurrection, and, you know, there's still a lot of controversy about that. Well, anybody could have rolled that stone back, you know.
And that's, of course, assuming that all of it is even true in the first place.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So, go ahead.
Well, there are biblical characters, I should say, in there. Herod is in here. He's all upset because of the things he did. He met this, along the way, he meets this brilliant scientist, if you will. He was Herod's counselor, teacher, instructor, best friend, etc. And Herod is belating the fact of what he had done at a birthday party a couple of years prior to that, because this man had, they met up, he had been to Egypt, and they met on the road to Jerusalem.
All right, and let's do this, Bob. Let's let people know where they can find out more about your book and order it.
Sure.
You want to give out your information and.
Yeah, can I give my website?
Absolutely. Please
do.
It's the same name as the book. It's www.atestimonyoflions.com. And the book can be purchased any place, from Amazon to any bookstore will order the thing for you if they don't have it in. And I'd like to invite anybody to check some of the comments that have come out on Amazon. As you probably know, they don't print about one-tenth of them, but they've so far I've been lucky. They've all been 5 stars.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll have, is Hollywood beating on your door yet?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, this thing just cries out to be, don't laugh at this, please, but I thought, you know, one of the most bankable stars in the world is Mel Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And banking is all there is to the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
And he took that thing, that the Passion of the Christ, to every production company, to every bank, to every studio, to every place. Couldn't get it done. He spent $25 million of his own money, and now he's grossing well over $600 million.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't have $25
million. Oh, you want to borrow some?
I would. Good.
Well, you know what? Even if you got George Lucas 1%, it would still be worth it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Hey,
gosh, that'd be great. You know, I mean, you think about some of the screen plays that make it to the movies or on TV, and I'm absolutely appalled, you know. And I just get this feeling that some people write these things and they just send them in, and it's just like, boom.
I look at this stuff and I say, how does this garbage get put on
film? Yeah, it makes you wonder.
There's a lot of good stories around.
Well, there's no imagination, and there's, you know, it's like a cookie cutter sort of thing. The other thing that I think is kind of disturbing too is the fact, and I know you guys will agree, is how you see these remakes of movies over and over again, the same themes, just in a different genre.
Well, that's got to tell you something. They run out of good material.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to we're kind of coming up on 45 minutes, and we've got some stuff that we're going to discuss as well, Bob. So we're going to kind of wrap up our part of the interview and move on to the next thing. But, you know, your book sounds interesting. It really does. I think the concept is very interesting. In fact, I'm going to have to read it myself.
I If you'll give me an address when we get off here, send or email you that my email. I'm going to send you a signed copy, both of you guys.
Wow. Well,
oh,
yeah.
That's wonderful. That's
I'll,
so kind
I'll,
of
I'll shoot you the address in chat in the Skype chat.
Good, and thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It was a real pleasure, and maybe we can have you back on again sometime.
Oh, yeah, and we wish you the best of luck with your book,
yes.
too, Bob.
Thank you.
Buena suerte with your libro.
Okay.
Yeah, and yeah, tell her hello, and have a great night.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Good night.
Thanks very much.
Good night. And if you want to get Bob's book, again, a testimony, or I guess it's just testimonyoflions.com, you can also get there by going to bobotis.com. It takes you to the same place, and you can order the book there, or you can get it in your local bookstore or on Amazon or wherever. Fine books are sold. Did that sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sounded like professional and all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure of that. So, interesting discussion of parts on time travel, some different theoretical issues, some different philosophical issues. And, you know, it obviously opens up a can of worms, Grant, on some of this stuff.
Yeah, you know, I just want to let folks know in the audience, I wasn't going off the deep end with Josephus. I think that there's, as an amateur historian, there's a lot of information that people just assume, and you really got to take a closer look at it. And I think as far as, and I'm not trashing any particular religion or anything else, but you have to look at the historical contents behind it. And a lot of times, some of the things that are written weren't written at the time that people were alive.
Yeah.
And they're anecdotal. And they're not based on facts. And, you know, the Romans and the Jews are pretty good record keepers. And, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't there in the records.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so much controversy and there's so much history that's we don't know about. And there's lots of holes. The Library at Alexandria.
Oh, yeah.
Burned. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that we have so many holes in our history. And I guess swinging this back around to time travel, I mean, you know, Bob mentioned Stephen Hawking, of course, and there's Michio Kaku, and there's other physicists who all allow for the possibility of time travel. Now, the interesting thing, I was watching a documentary the other day where they talked about forward time travel is, in fact, possible.
It is.
I mean, and it's very simple. I mean, and this is not exactly what we might think of, you know, in time travel. But if we were to go at the speed of light or near the speed of light, we would age normally while the rest of the world sped up. So we went out on a short trek at the speed of light and came back. Of course, everybody would be that we knew would be gone. So that is, in effect, traveling through time. However,
well, you do the same thing on an airliner.
Exactly.
Except the magnitude of time is so minuscule in comparison. That time, the faster you go, time actually slows down. But in comparison, that's called time dilation. And, you know, that's like with the twin brothers. One goes to Alpha Centauri. He ages, you know, 4 years. The other one back on Earth ages 70 years because of the time dilation, the compression of time. So, yeah, it's really a tricky thing. One can certainly, you know, can go forward. But the real question is, can you come back?
Mm-hmm. That is the big question. Can you go back in time? Now, obviously, I don't know.
But that's thinking, though, Doug, in strictly in linear terms. If you think of time in nonlinear terms, then it's plausible, to me at least, that you should be able to come back, go and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Especially think of an oxbow in a river. There should be parts where you could come back in fairly close proximity, but, you know, hey, 100 years may not be close enough.
Right. You know, I personally think that just about everything is possible. We just need to learn how. And, of course, with the breakthroughs that physics is now making, especially quantum physics, quantum mechanics, you know, a lot of the stuff that we thought as science fiction a few years or decades ago is true, like the multiverse. You know, parallel universes. I mean, they've all but shown that that's the case. You know, an electron can be in two places at the same time, or an atom. So, and they can communicate. You know, there's
multi-dimensions. String theory is based on multi-dimensions. you know, that we can't see and that we can't even comprehend at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, the whole parallel universe thing can come into play in paranormal research of a variety of ways, not only in parapsychology and hauntings, but also in ufology. I mean, there's been some conjecture, some speculating that when a ghost is seen or a spirit is felt or seen or an apparition, that sort of thing, you know, we're talking about a different, you know, we're talking about timelines or dimensions overlapping. The same is true with, you know, interdimensional aliens, or some have even speculated that on mysterious creatures such as Sasquatch. You know, maybe there's some overlapping of things. You know, that's all conjecture. It's all speculation. We have, of course, no way right now knowing that. But it's an interesting concept.
But, you know, though, too, you know, the one thing I thought that was, the one part that I find so troubling about creationism is that creationism is pure arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
It's pure human arrogance.
And just to be clear with everybody, the creationism basically states that the earth and the universe are 6,000 years old. That's creationism.
That is the most anthropomorphic, arrogant belief system. And this, I'm sorry, folks, I'm climbing on my soapbox here, because that eliminates so many possibilities and shuts down everything and narrows and makes those people essentially so myopic they can't see beyond the end of their nose.
Mm-hmm.
To assume in the galaxy as big as it is that we are special, that troubles me.
Well, we are special, but so is everybody else. We're not the only ones.
Yeah, thank you, Doug, for clarifying that. That we are the, let me put it as scientifically and professionally as I can, we're the specialists. We're God's favorites.
Specialists.
We're his most favorites.
Well, and that's the problem, you know. And there's a comment here in the chat room that's apropos, you know. Ange makes the statement that may explain why some apparitions appear in time period dress, you know, time shifts. And that's, you know, I mean, that would, it makes sense. I mean, you know, they appear that way. Of course, there's all kinds of speculation on why they do, but I think the whole parallel universe, quantum mechanics, and, you know, we've had Dr. Roll on before. We talked about quantum entanglement and PK, psychokinetic events. You know, there is somehow that they're all connected. There's some connection with all this. I don't know, Doug,
we had to tell them about what we experienced on Saturday night, last Saturday night.
Go for it.
Well, we went out to Brenda and Bud Hoshaw's to do some presentations for some Red Hawk Retreat.
We have the Paranexus monthly forum there.
Mm-hmm, yep. And so while we're out there, Gregory Kent was doing a table tipping exercise, and some of us were watching and others were talking in the background, and most of the people that were sitting at the table tipping were younger kids that wanted to get in on it because they had come out with their families and stuff, and so they're getting a big charge out of it. The table was moving. It always does out there. And wasn't paying a great deal of attention, but two of our best psychics were on the table that night, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, we started hearing a conversation about somebody who was very upset, who had supposedly come through that they had contacted. And that person was very upset, and they were complaining about a situation where a lot of people had died, and it wasn't fair what they had done to them. And I kind of overheard the conversation, and it reminded me of a situation that happened at the end of World War II. Which was the port of Chicago, where a large number of people, soldiers and sailors, were loading munition ships, and the ships blew up. Well, the contact that came through in the seance that night stated that it wasn't fair because they were black. And in that particular incident, 320 black sailors lost their lives. In a fraction of a second, they were vaporized in this tremendous explosion. And the thing that Doug and I had kind of talked about before we went on air was that didn't really strike me as odd at the time, but the longer I've thought about it, I just thought it was kind of a completely out-of-place sort of thing that was had a little tinge to the bizarre. That was my take.
Well, they were.
I mean, where did it come from?
Well, the thing is that you'd mentioned earlier off air was that these black sailors were loading these munition ships under unsafe conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like they were being taken advantage of, which is mm-hmm. unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And so the real thing, the power of this story is that they were at the table doing the table tipping, and you were nearby and you heard that, and then you made a comment. What did you say?
I just said they were. He's upset because they were black and they're discriminated against.
And then what did the table do?
The table was all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, and so
it was interesting.
And it came out of it. In fact, if you want to watch that segment of the table tipping, you can see it on Paranexus.org. If you go to the gallery and listen, you know, it's in there. Just go to the gallery and look for, under the video library, look for the Paranexus Monthly Forum and the table tipping videos there. We've got about, I don't know, 15, 16 minutes of it. But that it starts just about that time when Grant makes the comment about that, and the table kind of goes haywire. Kind of an interesting thing. We're coming up on our last three or so minutes here. So,
well, you know, the thing that was also interesting, Doug, was the fact that, you know, there were kids at that table. They would have never have known that.
Right.
That was, they were like, those kids weren't over 13 or 14 years old. And so the only two people who might have been familiar with that, because it's an obscure part of history, it's something a lot of people don't know about.
And I just...
adults.
Yeah, and that, you know, and if they had of, man, I just don't know. I'll have to ask them. I don't know if Gregory or Lori knew anything about it. And there were some other adults there, but, it was an interesting thing. Table tippings are always interesting, and it's part of our research, trying to figure out what exactly is going on with the table, and we continue to do that. We're going to have another Paranexus Monthly Forum. I believe it's, let me check the date. It's the second Saturday of May. That is going to be the 9th, May 9th. At Red Hawk Retreat. There is information on Paranexus.org right up at the top. And we haven't outlined the program yet, but it's we've got it slated to start at 6. You can get there as early as 4. The place is beautiful. Walk the grounds. We'll try to have a good program. And, of course, Gregory will typically be there and we'll usually be doing a table tipping afterward just as an informal thing. So, if you're interested in seeing a table tipping live or participating, then and you're in the Florida area, the Tampa, general greater Tampa area, or even in Florida, feel free to join us. Interesting time, a place to learn, a place to network and share and meet new people. It's a nice opportunity. So we're down to about a minute. Next week we have an interesting program. It is entitled Your Worst Nightmare, Supernatural Assault with Andrew Barnes and Paul Tate. This is a video that they produced about a number of things surrounding sleep paralysis, but not just sleep paralysis. So if you have any interest in abductions or in people waking up and seeing spirits, that kind of a thing, you may want to join us next week at on Paranexus Universe, Thursday night at 8 Eastern Time. And then coming up the week after, I don't have it on the site yet, but we just booked Jeff Hilling, who's going to talk about a new take on the Patterson-Gimlin video, the Bigfoot, the famous Bigfoot video. And he's got a website, Patterson, Patterson video. We'll have that available, though. So join us. We appreciate everybody's time tonight. Appreciate you joining us each week. Continue to try to book some great topics and some great guests. So, Grant, always a pleasure, my friend.
Me too, Doug. Everybody, you have a great weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Thursday night.
Good night. Take care.
Good night, everyone.
night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Paramex's universe.